Grace, the Amy Santiago of Royal Bloggers.
And I'm Jessica, the Dorothy Sporanath of Royal Bloggers.
And we'd like to welcome you to On Air, the podcast where two cynical Brits discuss the latest royal news and the truth behind the stories.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the On Air podcast. I thought I'd try something different.
I liked it. Very jazzy.
Yeah. Anyway, let's move on from that. So we've got a couple of topics for you today. We're going a bit more old school and traditional. We've got a couple more light bites, and old school listeners will remember the light bites when we used to do like four topics in one episode. So the first one, it all kicked off on the 27th of February. So there was a Thanksgiving service for King Constantine, who was the last king of Greece. You can go listen to episode 51, which is Mr. Kensington, where we talk about the Greek royal family and how messy it was and all of that. And it was being held at the church in Windsor, on the Windsor estate, the Greek royals and other royal families who were connected to the Greek royal family, including the Brits, went to this this Thanksgiving service. One of the people who did not go was Prince William, who is Constantine's godson. And considering no one outside of Greece has any idea who Constantine is, this caused a massive flurry of stories, William's non-attendance, which we're going to talk about, and we're going to try very, very hard not to get angry.
Yeah, I mean, I cannot promise anything about the not getting angry. So William was actually due to give a reading at this service. So at some point, he was definitely supposed to be attending because his name was in the programme. And then on the day, the Royal Reporter said that he wasn't going because he pulled out for, in quotation marks, personal matters. And then they went, also Kate is fine. But as always, the media then decided that this was clearly the one news story of the day and ran with it in every possible direction they could. From the factual William is not attending the service to why he's not attending in speculation to this means the end of the British monarchy.
Yes, that was my favourite part. I think it's what's interesting about this is that it's not actually that rare for royals to miss stuff. Like, they have colds. They're human beings. They're not superhuman. They do get colds and have to cancel things. So it's not unheard of that a royal would cancel something. It's also, whenever William cancels something, it tends to be either they say it's personal reasons or a prior engagement. They very rarely tell you exactly what is happening. And even, like, you know, he didn't go to Peter Phillips, his cousin. He didn't go to his wedding for a prior engagement. And that was quite a big family thing. And we definitely know he's closer to Peter than we know that he was to Constantine. And yet, for some reason, it just caused this absolute massive frenzy, probably because there's not much else going on that they can talk about.
Yeah, it definitely felt like the kind of stories that would come out in the middle of the summer.
Yeah. And yeah, the big main reaction is from the press, anyway. The royals need to be transparent or the monarchy will collapse, essentially. And look, I call for greater transparency all the time, but Constantine he wasn't Greek. He wasn't British. He was Greek. He did live in Britain for a little while, but he wasn't there when he died. He didn't contribute massively to British society in the way that lots of other people who have Thanksgiving services have. He was really just a guy who got fired from a job in a foreign country over 50 years ago. And it wasn't like he was a really beloved Greek president who died and it could damage our relationship with Greece for William to cancel with no good explanation. So it doesn't benefit or damage any British people. It doesn't benefit or damage our relationship with Greece, whether he went or not. So I just don't, it only really impacts like the 10 people who are members of the Greek royal family. And I think they are fully entitled to be furious with him if they want to. But as a member of the British public, I cannot say that I would care one way or another whether he did go to this Thanksgiving service or not. So calling for, it's weird to me that they could be calling for transparency around how the royals spend their money. They could be calling for transparency around the gift lists, which they don't seem to be publishing anymore. Anything, but to say we need to have transparency about why he didn't go to a Thanksgiving service of a man who doesn't impact anyone in Britain is an odd thing to me. The other thing I was thinking is, like, you also have to remember who is calling for transparency. And in this case, it's the media. And I would say that they have a vested interest. If you said to a journalist, would you rather have more information or less information? The journalist is always going to say, oh, well, I want more information. If this was him cancelling going to the coronation, for a personal matter, then sure, I would understand why people would be upset about it or would want to know or would feel like we have a right to know. And it is, you know, there have been situations where William's cancelled and I've thought, what could possibly be more important than this thing that you're going to, that's your job and that, you know, and you're not telling us. And I've been frustrated by that. But this is not one of those examples. I think this is just the press trying to cause a stir and put pressure on William to tell them. You know, they don't like that William's drawing this line in the sand around what he's going to tell them. I don't actually think that they're doing it because it's in the interests of the British people.
The word privacy causes a lot of sort of confusion because some people just are really pedantic about it and they're like, well, if you want privacy, how come you're ever outside of your house ever?
Yeah.
Or they kind of go the other way, they're like, yeah, if you, why we have to know every single thing that the royals do because we fund them, we fund their tax, you know, we are the taxpayers and they are taxpayer funded. But within that, you know, royals are still humans and humans still have like the human right of not having all of their secrets splashed across newspapers. Way back when Constantine first died, there was this real sort of group of people and journalists who were getting really het up because how dare William miss his godfather's funeral. And I was like, maybe people have different relationships with their godparents. I miss my godmother's funeral.
I wouldn't go to one of mine.
Yeah, I don't like it. My godfather, I asked him the other day, if he remembered he was my godfather. He did not. Like,
yeah.
I almost feel like there are so many ways you can push a godfather sort of relationship, and you could really push like angle with it to make the narrative you want. So you could write that William isn't going because he doesn't view a godfather relationship as being serious because he's not that into the church, which is a story that's been coming recently. Or you could push it that William doesn't care about family, which is obviously a big story that sort of flares up occasionally. And it's one of those topics that's really easy to catch hold of and then make into a big deal, even though the actual essence of the story is minuscule.
Yeah. I think the last time we saw them together was 2012, I think.
Yeah, I went through it every last time we've seen them, and it was the Jubilee Heads of State reception 2012, William and Kate's wedding, which everyone went to, and then 1999 for Constantine and Exios's christening. Like, they might have met each other in between. We didn't see everything they do. But in the last nearly 30 years, they saw each other 3 times.
Yeah, yeah. Not that close. I see a lot of people 3 times in 30 years, you know. One thing I admire about Kensington Palace is that once they've decided, they're not going to be backed into a corner. They're going to stick to their guns. And sometimes I don't agree with the decision that they make. But I admire the fact that William clearly is like, no, I'm not going to tell people. And that's that. And I think that's something that has been consistent throughout after a decade of royal watching. I've kind of given up on trying to fight things that I know I'm going to lose. And it also, in the grand scheme of things, if I am going to fight for something that is a losing battle, it's not going to be this because it wouldn't have impacted anybody in the UK if he did go. So why does it matter if he didn't, is basically my view. Yeah. So I think ultimately, mounted out of a molehill, that this part of the story is actually, you know, it's typical for the press to make something dramatic out of something that is not actually that dramatic. I'm kind of used to it.
Yeah, there've been loads of stories like this that we've just never mentioned There's like 5 a day.
Yeah, you roll your eyes and you move on. But I genuinely didn't anticipate the frenzy that kicked off, that's perhaps overwhelmed that story, which is actually about Kate, who wasn't even there at all and was never supposed to go.
Yeah, so like, just a little refresher for everyone. Way back in January, Kate had surgery and Kensington Palace released a statement that was very long. We spoke about it in this podcast. And as part of said statement, they explicitly said the Princess of Wales will not return to public engagements before Easter. However, the entire world jokes on social media that have then spiraled into serious discussions on social media to actual newspapers and news outlets writing genuine think pieces, to the BBC writing an analysis on where is Kate Middleton?
At home, the end.
Yeah, she's in bed, guys.
Yeah.
Oh, and yeah, I wrote my notes and I had to stop several times just to go and scream in a pillow because I was like...
I'd subdivided the reactions to this to kind of stupid questions, conspiracy theories, and then jokes/memes. There's definitely been this kind of process that has happened. You don't just have memes that spring up out of nowhere. Memes are sort of something that develop, the result of mutations of a story throughout a community. So the way I thought about it was kind of like concentric circles. And I think in the center, you have the press. The next circle is, I think, the people who follow royal reporters. A lot of those people, particularly on Twitter, are people who kind of joined when Harry and Meghan arrived in the royal family. That might be because they love Harry and Meghan. It also could be because they hate Harry and Meghan. I'm not saying that this is like a, you know, a Harry and Meghan, Kate and William side thing. It's just people who joined relatively recently because of a specific event and not because they're interested in royals. They like the gossip, they like the drama, but they're not really interested in learning about like how royals work and what they do and why they exist. And so I think when you got to this group, the people who are reacting to the initial story, they seem to think, well, the only possible reason that William could have missed this event is because Kate's dead. There's no other possible reason that he could have missed it, which led to the sort of the first stage for me, which was all of the stupid questions.
The initial response from the press, which was Kate's fine, I personally immediately thought, oh, thank God, because I was like, oh, that's a relief. That's something I do not need to worry about, because I think it's very rational for William to say he can't attend something for a personal matter when you know his wife is ill, and your reaction to be like, oh, something's wrong with his wife. It's, you know, or his dad. Sorts of people initially, way back at the beginning, say, well, maybe Charles is more poorly than we thought, despite the fact his wife was there. And then, like you said, that the kind of the next sort of the Royal Watcher reaction was bizarrely like Kate's seriously ill. And I think when and this isn't anti-Harry and Meghan at all, but I think when Harry and Meghan were like everywhere, when they were first sort of together in that lead up till their wedding, and there were so many press stories, and some of them were true and some of them were not true, and some of them were opinion pieces, which never have to be true because they're an opinion piece. There's this kind of weird unbelief that the press just can straight up lie, but which they can't. If they do that, they have to apologize. They can very heavily twist the truth, like they can imply something.
And they can get things wrong.
Yeah, but they can't say Kate is fine if they know she is dead. Like, that's not allowed.
It's not Thailand, but exactly. And I think a lot of the questions were kind of, oh, well, where is she? I'm really starting to worry about Kate. You know, it's actually, now that you think about it, it's really quite weird that we haven't seen her, blah, 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 blah. So they were sort of wrapping it up as being about concern and about sort of, oh, I'm concerned about Kate and I'm concerned about her health. And I actually think out of all of the reactions to this, and we're going to go through some of them, but I think out of all of the reactions, it was this section that irritated me the most because I think the statement that they released was so clear, and it's on their social media. It was talked about in every newspaper. If you go on her Wikipedia page, I'm sure you could find a link to the statement and probably a a description of what's the situation on there. And I talked about this on Tumblr. This is the section that irritated me the most because I don't expect people to know something just because I know it. We all have gaps, but I do expect people to be able to show some basic level of self-restraint. Pre-social media, you would gossip with your friends and you might say, oh, I think Kate's actually much more sick than they're telling us. You might have done that with friends, but you wouldn't go into a public square and scream random thoughts about it to people, to anyone who walked past. Whereas nowadays, we've reached a point where, this is going to make me sound like such a boomer, but nowadays, we've reached a point where people think that that's not only like socially acceptable, but like the norm. It just really bothers me that nobody is willing to take 30 seconds to look things up. If it was a really complicated statement, if it was hard to find, if they'd been really vague, I would have understood people being ignorant and asking all of these questions. But like, it's just people treating Twitter as like a search engine. And like, if you want to know where is Kate, go to Google and search it and you'll find the answer. And then you don't have to post. But it's just, I think what I've written here, my conclusion is that you can't be loud and ignorant. You have to pick one.
Some things in the story that annoyed me a lot and made me upset, but I didn't have the same kind of visceral gut reaction because we don't know. Like, I don't know for a fact that right now, you know, where Kate is. She might be in bed, she might be on holiday. I don't know that. I just know she's not at work. But I know that she's not at work because they said, I mean, the exact sentence was based on current medical advice, she is unlikely to return to public duties until after Easter. And even if, you know, she's absolutely fine and they're just playing. We were told explicitly she wouldn't be back until after Easter. So when people are going, where is she? I'm like, but you're, it says there is an answer to your question. And it's that kind of blatant, it's the ignorant. It's not, what's the word? It's like, it's not accidental ignorance, it's like chosen ignorance.
Yes.
Like the answer is there and you have either not looked for it or you are deliberately ignoring it because it's not fitting the narrative or the questions that you want to pose.
Yeah, exactly. And I had a message about this that made me very angry and I deleted it because I couldn't have answered it in a way that was like not potentially a crime. But one of the many things they said was like, oh, well, people might have forgotten. I was like, but then you look it up again. If you forget something, you go and look at it and try and find what the answer was. It's disingenuous to imply that those people who were commenting genuinely didn't even know that Kate was sick. Because how would anybody who doesn't follow Kate know that it's unusual for her and that she hasn't appeared out? Like, if you're not a royal watcher and you don't really pay attention to royals, you probably have absolutely no idea what Kate has or hasn't done. You don't know that she doesn't always, you know, start working in March, because the idea of royals is they don't do anything. So she probably always starts in March, you know. So it shouldn't be difficult for you to, even if you've forgotten the statement's exact wording, to go and look it up. And this is why this section irritates me the most out of all of it, is because people are, you know, acting like, oh, I'd just forgotten, or, oh, I'm just really concerned. But in reality, what they're doing is just deliberately ignoring what they actually do know. I don't think that it is people asking questions because they genuinely are concerned. I think it's people who are just trying to stir up drama.
You know, whether it's intentional or not, they are putting out questions that will only antagonize the situation.
Yeah, definitely. Because I actually blame these people for everything that happened subsequently, to be honest, because I think they opened the door to this. Because if you are asking frenzied, hysterical questions that are challenging an established narrative that they've given you based on absolutely nothing other than your own, you know, desire to make gossip and drama, and then especially if you're trying to, like, frame it as this, oh, I'm so concerned, which they did with Mary, they did with Charlene, they've done it so many times, and it annoys me every single time. But, you know, I think it, once you open that door and start asking these questions, then obviously other people are going to start stepping in to answer the questions, because you have asked a question on a public platform. So that moves me on to the conspiracy theory people.
Yes, that's a perfect timing to move on.
Yeah. I guess there's been a whole range of them, but, you know, sort of Kate's actually in a coma and they don't want to tell us. Kate was actually getting plastic surgery and they don't want to tell us. Her and William are getting a divorce and that's, and, you know, they've hidden her from public view and they just don't want to tell us. And he was, you know, missed it because he was at home, I don't know, sorting out some divorce thing. She's an alcoholic and she had to get a liver transplant and they don't want to tell us about that. And, you know, so there's all sorts of strange conspiracy theories.
Yeah, I think, and they really range as well. And some of them I find very easy to laugh off because I'm like, well, that's stupid. Obviously, it's not true. And then some of them lean into incredibly kind of cruel and callous ones, which don't upset me in the same way. They don't irritate me, I think. That's the difference. I think they don't irritate me. I don't get annoyed with them. And not to sound incredibly soppy, but I would much rather assume happy things and nice things are happening than horrible, sad things. And some of the things that, you know, I'm doing my best to avoid some of these conspiracy theories because I'm like, I don't need that negativity in my life. But some of them are so sort of cruel and callous, not just about Kate, about, you know, the people around her, about her friends, about their family members. And it's like, who comes up with this? Who sits at home and thinks, you know what, I'm just going to throw out there into the conversation some kind of joint murder-suicide situation? I'm like, you don't need to be doing that. There's no need for these. I get, you know, the odd rumours. It's not like the British royal family has not had their share of conspiracy theories. There have been minutes. There have been some about Kate before. There have been loads about Diana, about Meghan, about William, about Charles, about Camilla, about the Queen, about this. They've all had them. And you can't sit there and be upset about all of them, or you'd never do anything else in your life. But I like a nice conspiracy theory sometimes. I like to look through like the weirdest conspiracy theories out there just so I can have a bit of a laugh. If I'm coming up with my own personal conspiracy theories, like the moon doesn't exist or whatever, like I'm not, like you said, I'm not broadcasting it, and they're also not harmful. And I think some of these, and not, these aren't the only conspiracy theories in the world, but a lot of them lean heavily into stereotypes or into sort of promoting sort of like homophobic ideals or anything like that, and all these kind of odd beliefs. And I'm like, you are causing an issue here. You're promoting, you know, there might be, I don't even know if I've seen this, but there'll be like a conspiracy theory that Kate's broken up with William because he's really into gay men. And it's like, so what you're actually doing is promoting homophobia right now, because there's no evidence this has happened. And you're just suggesting that if William was gay, he's not worthy of, you know, having his privacy kept and we should just out him. And I'm like, you are the problem, guys.
This is why I think it's important to say that a lot of the conspiracy theories, especially early on, came from people who know a little bit about the royals. They generally hate Kate and have tried on repeated occasions to advance narratives that we have no evidence for. But they are people who know a little bit about royals, enough to make what they're saying slightly believable, because there's been loads of stories about William and Kate and their relationship, and there's no evidence to suggest that they aren't anything other than a happy couple. They might not be, but there's no evidence to suggest otherwise. But there's been so many stories that they know that if they tap into that, that people will believe it. So I think they're designing these conspiracy theories to cause harm, as much harm as possible. They are very, very specific and very, very deliberately designed to be believable. And I think it's cruel and it's unnecessary. And, you know, there are people who will argue when I say something like, oh, I think they're probably just a happy couple, you'll get people being like, yeah, but you don't have any evidence to support that they are a happy couple. So how is what you're saying any more valid than me saying that they're not a happy couple with no evidence? But I think it goes back to what you were saying of, like, even though this is the podcast where we bill ourselves as being very cynical people, and I am a very cynical person, I don't like causing harm to people. I don't think I'm the best person in the universe, but I don't go out of my way to hurt people, whether I know them or not. It feels like these are basic principles that are part of a functioning society. I don't understand the standpoint that people have where they dislike somebody so much that they are going to go out of their way to cause as much harm as possible to as many people associated with that person as possible. Like, there are lots of people that I don't like, but I don't like them because of the things that they've actually done. So I can say I don't like them because of this thing that they've actually done. I don't need to make up rubbish in order to try and damage them.
Yeah, it's like, I mean, I grew up Catholic, so I feel like all my weird idioms about this are very Catholic related, but, like, you know, the whole, like, you know, treat other people as you would like to be treated, it's just a common rule. Like, I've seen a lot of people being like, well, you know, people who are, I'm not saying this is coming from fans of Meghan, but I've seen people who've been like, well, Meghan was treated awfully by the royal family. By the royal family or by the press or by the British public. So it's fine that we also do it to Kate, or people, or they do it to Diana. See, Diana was treated horribly, so it's fine that we also do it to Kate. And I mean, I've never got that logic and that kind of, like, and it's one of those things where, you know, they're in children's TV shows when, like, a little child will be mean to another child, and then the moral figure comes over and goes, oh, did that make you feel better? And the kid goes, not really. And they're really grumpy and they have a big talk about how hurting other people doesn't actually make you feel better. But it's a genuine thing. It doesn't make you feel better long term to hurt other people.
Yeah. People need to go and watch Sesame Street again, because they clearly aren't remembering the learnings from that. They know these aren't true. That's the thing. I don't believe that they believe them. Like, the people who think the world is flat, or that the moon doesn't exist, or the moon landings were fake, I believe that they believe that. They're wrong. But I think that they genuinely, for whatever reason, hold those views and they 100% believe them. But it's these people who are, like, tapping into the conspiracy theory audience to, like, sell something or to boost their profile, or in this case, to just sort of advance a general narrative that these people are terrible and not worth anything, and we should say whatever we want and do whatever we want to them.
I also think, like, the people they're causing the most harm to aren't the royals. Like, I seriously doubt, you know, William and Kate are sat in bed and be like, oh, it's so not fair, people are being really mean about us. Like, people are mean about them every day. The people they're upsetting are, like, the normal people who are, like, just living their lives and are coming across this and being like, hell, that's not fair. Or people who have been victims of domestic abuse and are like, why is this now a punchline and a joke?
Yeah,
it's the normal people are being hurt rather than the people they're supposedly aiming at. On the same day, in fact, of the 27th, on the day of Constantine's weird Thanksgiving service, Buckingham Palace announced that Thomas Kingston, who was the husband of Lady Gabriella Windsor and the son-in-law of Prince and Princess Michael, had died. And then they had to very quickly announce that that's not William's personal matter, guys.
Yeah.
Just in case. And normally that would have got absolutely no traction whatsoever, because Nobody in the world knew who Thomas Kingston was apart from his friends and family. But because it came out sort of right in the centre of all of this sort of spiralling news, his death was immediately turned into some sort of weird conspiracy theory. And Thomas Kingston isn't related to the royal family, but he's a private citizen. He is not royal. He does not get taxpayer funding. He is just a normal man who happened to be married to someone who's a lady.
Yeah. He's like 57th in line to the throne or something ridiculous.
Yeah, he's very far removed from anything. He, you know, does not benefit, but he died. It was a sudden death. It was clearly very upsetting for his family. And the public immediate response was to assume that it was some kind of weird relationship theory that was heavily linked to what was going on with William Kate, which not only must have been incredibly hard for his wife and his in-laws and his brothers and sisters to read about, but I imagine made a really horrible situation worse, because I imagine someone in the family had to go to Ella or to her family or to the Kingston family and say, look, I'm really sorry, but just in case you go on social media, there are some really weird rumours about your recently deceased husband.
Yeah.
You know, that your close family member has murdered him, or that he was involved in some kind of torrid affair, or, you know, all these weird things. It's one of the moments that it's always hard to talk about, because it's the sort of the darkest part of the whole story, because, you know, a man has died in very sad circumstances, and people have immediately turned it into some kind of like, ha-ha, funny joke, let's see how we can hurt people with someone's death.
As cruel as I think people can get, and I don't understand how people are okay putting that on social media forever. Like I don't know. I'm not saying that I'm this perfect person. I have anger issues and I have my problems and all that, but I wouldn't do that.
And I also feel like some of the blame has to lie on the people who are repeating it as like, I can't believe people are saying this. There is a tendency for people to be like, I'm really upset because I've seen these 47 messages on the internet and they put them out there, and people who hadn't seen them because they weren't in that part of the internet are now seeing them in a new sort of space, a new sphere. People who would take them out from that initial circle of royal watchers to the general public. Because I think, you know, conspiracy theories very much only spread if people spread them. And there were a lot of people who almost like fake outrage, like, I can't believe someone would say this horrible thing, here you go, and then just sort of let it spread more. And I think I feel like, to a point, people know, I mean, I know what I'm doing when I do that to like my sister, when I'm like, hey, see this, sister, like I know I'm doing it to wind her up, and I think people know they're doing that, but it almost feels like it's okay because it's on the internet.
I think as soon as you engage in certain conversations, you give that conversation and the people who are advancing those things power. And I know that, like, obviously we're partly guilty of that because we've got a podcast and we're talking about it now. By the time this comes out, it'll be so far past that we're not really advancing something that anyone else doesn't already know about. But yeah, no, I agree with you basically that just like you have to be really careful, because even if something really, really upsets you, you have to think to yourself, is this really the battle that I want to fight right now? Or am I going to be legitimizing this point of view, or making myself look irrational, or making myself look worried? Like, I think, oh, maybe there's a kernel of truth in what they're saying, and that's why I'm getting so angry about it. Or like, you know, sometimes it's better to just let stupid people be stupid and not engage with them.
That's good. That's a good little tagline.
Yeah. That's my principle for life. But yeah, I think the third circle, once we got past that, was kind of the general public. But this is where we start to get into the jokes and the memes. And so when I spoke on Tumblr about this, it was before the memes and the jokes were really taking off, and it was more the conspiracy theories and questions. And I had someone message me about 24 hours later, once the memes and the jokes had already taken off, and saying, oh, well, it's just a joke. People obviously did know about the statement. Everybody has excellent reading comprehension skills and does loads of research, and you're completely wrong about that, because it was just a joke. They were deliberately pretending that they didn't know. And I mean, I think firstly, I think it's funny when someone says to me something isn't happening, and then in the course of their message they do the thing that they say isn't happening. That's always very amusing to me. But anyway, I think the most of the general public who only really pay attention to something if it's trending. And so because of the sort of, this is why one of the reasons why I hold this first group responsible, is because you know, somebody saw something trending on Twitter, went and clicked on it, and what they saw was this absurd hysteria about where is Kate? Where is Kate? I'm so worried about her. I'm so worried about her. Then they saw these insane conspiracy theories, and so they did what the public does, which is they made memes. I should just say, you know, this anonymous person said to me, like, oh, it's just a joke. And I actually don't have a problem with most of the jokes in the memes, even if I don't think they're funny, even if I maybe find them slightly irritating. I can't say just because I don't find something funny that other people shouldn't be allowed to make the joke. And the reason that I think that most of the jokes in the memes and things are funny, are okay, is because the joke, they're only funny because they're unbelievable. So one of the ones that I've seen, for example, so at the moment in the UK, they're building up to the launch of the next series of Celebrity Big Brother, which is a reality TV show for celebrities. And so I've seen people say, oh, well, where's Kate? Kate's gone on waiting to go on to Celebrity Big Brother. And the only reason that is funny is because obviously Kate is not going on Celebrity Big Brother.
I mean, it'd be quite impressive if she was. I would be like, fair enough.
In order to find that joke funny, you have to think, oh, well, Kate is the last person who would go on Celebrity Big Brother because she's, you know, she's very classy, she's rich, she's got this image as being quite sort of, quite royal and regal, and it's not somebody who you'd ever imagine going on Celebrity Big Brother. Whereas if somebody said that, you know, this reality star, Joey Essex or whatever, has disappeared from public view to go on Celebrity Big Brother, everyone would go, oh yeah, okay, maybe. And somebody says, oh no, it was a joke. I was like, well, it's not a joke because it's believable. Like, it's just a statement or a piece of gossip. So I think that in a lot of the cases, the reason that I don't have a problem with a lot of the jokes in the memes is because, yeah, they're not believable, but they're also not actually targeting Kate. A joke like that about, like, the Celebrity Big Brother one, the target of that joke is the people who are being hysterical and getting into a frenzy and advancing conspiracy theories about Kate. And so, you know, those people are not advancing this as a genuine, legitimate conspiracy theory. And so therefore, whether they researched it or any of that, you know, that doesn't really matter. Whereas I think the first reactions, some of the conspiracy theories and the sort of faux concern posts, those are targeted to Kate, and they are deliberately designed to seem as believable as possible, to have like a kernel of something in there that people might be able to believe. So they're designed to cause as much harm as possible. So I think, like, there is a difference between a joke and a meme about this situation, which, even if I don't find funny, people are allowed to do it, and actually conspiracy theories that are being advanced because they want you to believe it.
There are plenty of memes about this that I've sort of scrolled past and just been like, well, fair enough. And there are some that have genuinely made me laugh. Like, I quite like the one where they're like, yeah, you know who we also haven't seen since Christmas? Banksy.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, I'll take that. Or, you know, she's at the Willy Wonka experience in Scotland, or she's growing out bangs. You know, all those classic ones. Hilarious to me. I'm like, yeah, of course, that's definitely what it is.
Yeah.
And that, you know, it's that kind of the punching up versus punching down humour. Like, this humour is not harming anyone. You know, even if you're sitting there and, you know, there are plenty of memes I scroll past that I just haven't found funny, but I'm like, I get it. I understand that, because it's also, you know, it's a type of thing, once again, going back to your whole stop putting things on the internet thing, that I would do at home, you know? Mm. Like, I've definitely made jokes about Kate and William or Charles or whoever when I was sat at home with my family and be like, oh, but I know what they're doing. They are not designed, like you said, to cause harm to anyone. Even the people there, they're there to wind someone up, and they're winding up that first group. And I mean, you've got to kind of respect a bit of annoying people that are annoying. but even then, it's not designed to hurt them. It's just designed to be like, you're being an idiot.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I think it's really important to say that, because I know that we can come across, or I can come across, as like a bit of a spoilsport and somebody with no sense of humor. And I'm very much drawing a distinction between that and saying, I think that William was in a homosexual relationship with Thomas Kingston and killed him and is covering it up, and that's why he missed Constantine's Thanksgiving service. I'm not one of those people who's overly sensitive about every single thing. And, you know, there are some people who anything that is remotely seems to be mocking Kate, they're like, oh, well, this is the worst thing ever, and I'm going to get really angry about it. Like, it's fine. She's allowed to be mocked. And I'm sure that some of them she probably would find quite funny. But there is a line, and that's what I'm those are the people that I'm talking about, is the people who are saying things that are designed to be believable and are designed to cause harm.
Part of the reason they get so kind of amalgamated into the same thing is that you have these kind of, I don't want to call them pious because it feels like the wrong word, but these sort of people who like to lean into fake outrage,
yeah,
who put them all together, and they sort of, they put them on the same level. Like Kate's got a bad haircut and Kate's been murdered are the same level of awful, where one is quite cruel and one is very funny, I've got to be honest.
Yeah, yeah. So,
they, because they are making them both equally awful, people then get more kind of, they want to rile them up more, and in doing so their conspiracy theories become more outlandish and more, no, not conspiracy, the memes become more sort of outlandish and more likely to cross over that line. And you almost have to like find that group of outraged people and just block them or get rid of them, because the more they keep going, the more they feed into this sort of spiral of memes. So there are times when I've looked at a conspiracy theory and I've got all sort of riled up in my head and I've written out a really long Tumblr post, and then I've breathed and come back to it and gone, I'm just going to delete that now because my thoughts don't need to be out in the world about this. And I think it's okay to be really angry at something, to see something and be like, no, actually,
yeah,
it makes me feel really, really uncomfortable. I don't like it. But you, if you are publicly responding to it all the time, every single one you see, you are perpetuating the cycle. Like, if there is one that is, you know, horrendously awful, and you think, you know, you are...
the line, yeah.
Sort of, yeah, but of course, if you are perpetuating the harm by not addressing maybe the underlying issues within it, fair free, go for it. But most of the time, you're just making yourself more upset.
Yes. Yeah, I think what you're saying is right. Like, you have to think about what is going to perpetuate the harm. I like that, of kind of, sometimes it's answering the what's going on, and sometimes it's letting it go unchecked. And it's just about finding that distinction. And I would highly recommend, you know, as somebody who has had anger issues and really was not on the right side of this line for quite a long time, I think my biggest piece of advice is, if you write something, put it in your drafts and then come back to it an hour later and think if you feel the same way, because it will save you a lot of bother.
Hints and tips there.
Hints and tips from an old grizzled member of the fandom.
For our second light bite of the episode, oddly, we're staying with the British royal family, which was the judicial ruling on the court case between the King on behalf of the Duke of Sussex and the Secretary of State for the Home Office, or in layman's terms, Prince Harry and the Security Service. Spoiler alert, but the outcome was he was wrong and the Security Service was right and he did not really have a case. So just over 2 years ago, in January 2022, Harry essentially launched this legal case against the government, which essentially was alleging that the decision to remove this sort of high-level security service for him and his family was unlawful. And it kind of rumbled on in the background for a really long time. And then the official ruling came out on the 28th of February, which was conveniently 4 years after they made their initial decision not to give him the finding, which I liked. I was like, oh, fun, nice round numbers there, guys.
Yeah, I liked that as well. Yeah, like the anniversary. What a present. Yeah, so we talked about this a little bit in episode 33. They don't tell you the exact level of security that people get. So we don't actually know exactly what was taken away from Harry and what exactly what he was offered instead. But we do have a sort of vague idea. Before they left, Harry and Meghan were sort of looked after, their security was looked after and decided by this group called RAVEC. And they decided that after they left, that Harry was no longer part of the RAVEC cohort, but that because of the fact that he was part of the royal family, he would probably require some level of security when he visited the UK. And so basically their decision was that instead of automatically getting the same level of security he'd had when he was a royal anytime he visited the UK, he would have to put in writing a request 28 days in advance of a visit to the UK with his itinerary. And then RAVEC would make a decision on a case-by-case basis of what he would need for that particular visit. You know, as I mentioned, it's difficult to know. Like, obviously, if what they'd said was you used to have three armed, high-level, trained security personnel, and instead we're going to give you my neighbor's eight-year-old son with a water pistol. Like, that might be an understandable thing that Harry was angry about. Yeah, so we're going to sort of take you through why this decision was made, because it is quite a dense legal document. And we had a couple of people who specifically asked us to talk about this. And one of them was a lawyer who was sort of like, good luck, sort of, because it's a very dense opinion. An opinion is what the judge puts out, is his verdict, I guess, is an opinion. And something else that we kind of have to acknowledge before we even get into the episode is that not just the fact that it's dense, because I think Grace and I are both nerds. We like reading court documents. It's one of the things that unites us in our friendship, is the fact that we both love reading long, boring court documents and will at every opportunity. But I think that it's even harder to read than an ordinary court opinion, because it's talking about matters of national security. And so half of the document was redacted. I actually think we might as well call this episode title is redacted in brackets, because everything in this document was redacted. There might be things that are in the redacted sections that actually would change our opinion or would change how we feel about this, but we can only use the information that we have been given.
There were some cracking sentences where it's like, and then this person said redacted and redacted and then redacted because of redacted. Yeah. Like, just redact the whole thing, guys. Don't need the word and in there.
You sent me your favourite one, which was just a line that said, so far as redacted text is concerned, redacted text. That's all it said. So we don't know what it was about, and we don't know what the subsequent information was. It was the least helpful sentence that has ever been written.
But yeah, it was great fun to read.
Helpfully, they did release a sort of summary. The shorter judgment kind of outlines the claims that Harry was bringing as to why he thought the decision by Ravec was unlawful. There's broadly three claims. The first was that Ravec didn't follow their policy and they didn't have a good reason for deviating from that policy. The second was that the decision was irrational and no reasonable decision maker would reach the same decision. And there's a few things that came under that, but the main argument from Harry was that his level of risk hasn't changed, and so why would his security change? And then the third one was that it was procedurally unfair. So essentially that was because he felt that he wasn't told about the decision-making in advance. He wasn't given the opportunity to state his case in advance. So the first one was that they didn't follow policy. Based on the information that we do know, what it seems like happens normally when Harry was a working royal is that once a year, there would be this group of people who met called the Risk Management Board. And the Risk Management Board, the RMB, includes policy and security experts who provide expert advice to Ravec based on a kind of holistic assessment of the threat against individual royals. And then Ravec used that and other things to make their decision about what level of security is appropriate. And when Harry and Meghan left, it seemed like there was about 4 months before Harry's next RMB analysis was scheduled. And so Sir Richard Mottram, who was the chair of Ravec at the time, so he was ultimately the man who made this decision, he decided not to do a new full RMB analysis. Instead, what he asked for was he got some sort of threat assessments, which are less detailed, less sort of holistic, but they are still threat assessments from experts in the government. And they are highly secure documents, which are not even shared with the person who's the target. So Harry isn't allowed to see them. they were only given in this particular court case because they sort of were part of the case, but they would ordinarily never be shared with even the person involved. And Harry's argument was essentially that it was wrong for them not to do this RMB analysis because in their terms of reference, it states that they will consider the RMB analysis when they're making decisions. And so he thinks that he should have got a new one to decide whether or not he continued to get security and was continued to be considered part of the Ravec cohort. That's a lot of information. But basically, the gist of it is the judge said that Harry's interpretation was, quote, mechanistic and overly literal.
Yeah, I like, there was a part in the long one instead of the short one where clearly Harry's lawyers had put forward other cases where things could be applied, and the judge went through like case by case and was like, so that's irrelevant in this situation, and that doesn't count in this situation, and that just is wrong. Which was quite fun to read, because then I got to find out all these other cases I could go and learn about. And the judge said that any deviations from this kind of set law, the original sort of bare bone skeleton were justified. Possibly because, you know, of the situation it was in, and the long document, the full review, went through almost day by day, minute by minute, every single decision that was made from the moment Harry and Meghan said they were stepping down as working royals in January 2020 until the moment they made their decision on the 28th February 2020.
They decided that he, like, because he's not living in the UK anymore, this process that they normally use under RAVEC does not apply to him. So he therefore is not part of this RAVEC cohort, which is the people that they provide security for. He's now sort of like an extraordinary member, they refer to him as. So kind of like he's not in the RAVEC cohort, but when he does have security, it's RAVEC who makes the decision, basically, is what they decided. And Harry said that whether or not he should have been part of the RAVEC cohort, whether or not he should have continued to get security at the same level, should have been determined by this RMB analysis. But as the defense pointed out, and when I read this, I was like, oh, this is really good. Because as the defense pointed out, if the RMB analysis was the only tool that decided whether somebody was part of the RAVEC cohort or not, then you would have to do it for every single person in England, Scotland and Wales in order to determine whether or not they are in the RAVEC cohort. What they were arguing was essentially like there must be something else that qualifies you for even being able to have an RMB analysis in the first place, which is essentially your position, your status, the fact that you're a working royal, the fact that you are a public figure in the UK. And so Harry was basically saying that, well, that's not important. That doesn't matter. It should have only been based on the RMB analysis. But they were saying like, well, there has to be something else. We can't do an RMB analysis for everybody in the country. So the fact that you are no longer a working royal and that you were leaving is an important part of our decision. And it was relevant for us to consider it. So that's the judge was essentially saying that, like, even if the RMB policy was, you know, like even if the policy was that you have to do an RMB analysis for every single person who falls within the RAVEC cohort, they made the decision that he wasn't part of the RAVEC cohort anyway, based on the fact that he was leaving his role as a working royal. So he still wouldn't have been entitled to have one automatically. That's very confusing, but does that make sense?
Definitely makes sense.
Okay.
The RAVEC sort of legal team were very sort of detailed with being like, with sort of taking apart this argument, with even things as simple as most people who are in this RAVEC cohort reside in the UK. Already, you're a special case within the discussion in the first place, because normally they don't do it for people in overseas territories or other Commonwealth. It is a UK-based thing. Like you said, like Harry was taking the law so literally. So then they were like, okay, we'll take it literally as well and do one for every single person, because that's officially what the writing says. And it kind of goes back to what we were mentioning in our episode about the Constitution, where we were like, so much of it is tradition and sort of practice rather than what is actually physically written down.
So, yeah, and they also, the judge also sort of found that according to the evidence that was presented, the experts stated that, especially at the time this decision was made, the RMB analysis was not perfect. And they determined that in this particular instance, a flexible process was better for Harry because he was only going to be coming in a few times a year. He wasn't, you know, and it wasn't going to be the same situation as somebody like William or Anne or whoever. So I think, again, this is a little bit of sort of making assumptions based on what's in the text, because some of it is redacted. But it seems to me like for somebody like Anne, she gets an RMB analysis every single year, and then she gets kind of like a blanket security package. Whereas what they offered to Harry was a bespoke package of support, which means that every single time he comes to the UK, he says, I'm coming to the UK and this is what I'm going to be doing. And they create a tailored package for that specific itinerary. Essentially, the RMB analysis wasn't actually the best tool to use anyway in this particular instance. And what Harry has got is better, in their view, than what he would have got if he just got the RMB analysis. And the judge kind of said, like, ultimately, Sir Richard Mottram and all of the other witnesses who were part of this and all the other people who were part of the RAVEC process are national experts in security and policing. And so there's no justification for Harry to think that he knows what tools are better for analysis than the people who are the experts in this. He never advanced anything that suggested that they weren't actually experts. They surely, in terms of how the policy works, in terms of what tools are available and what's most appropriate, they are better qualified to know than Harry is.
I think the thing is, with this bespoke package, he could end up with more security than he originally had on certain visits. If, like, they look, judge, that there is a threat a significant threat to him on a return, he might end up with significantly more security than anyone else in the country has at that exact moment. I imagine reading the initial verdict way back in 2020, which is it's not going to be the same as everyone else, I think rationally and probably quite rightly, your assumption, if it was you, would be to be like, oh, so I'm being sort of demoted. Mm-hmm. I've been decreased off the list. And, you know, I in no way sort of blame him for that at all. It was clearly a really sort of emotionally wrought time. But looking at it 4 years later, rationally, surely at this point, it's very clear that if Harry needs the security, the bespoke package he is being offered, it sounds like we're giving him a spa package. Mm. The bespoke package being offered, he could have, you know, more. And I think it from reading it felt very much like Harry was stuck in 2020. Mm-hmm. And all the emotions he felt then, he sort of kept to them. And every time it comes up, he's like, oh, I'll just return to that sort of emotional period and sort of regurgitate the same thoughts.
Yeah, it felt to me like somebody at some point mentioned, oh, well, normally we do an R&B analysis and this is the biggest or the most detailed analysis. And he really has latched on to this concept of like, I have to have an R&B analysis. It's the most important thing in the entire universe. I have to have it, have to have it, have to have it. And the judge kind of acknowledged like, you're allowed to feel that that was wrong, but that doesn't make it illegal that they didn't do it. So the second ground that Harry essentially had was that it was unreasonable, or, you know, no rational decision maker would have come to the same decision that they did. And I think that's quite technical legal language as to, you know, the terms unreasonable and irrational are probably like have some specific legal definition. But in our terms, it was generally that his risk didn't change. So it makes no sense that their decision was changed, but, you know, to give it the level of security that he got was changed, because the risk is the only factor that matters, and his risk hadn't changed. And so it's quite similar to the first point, but the argument the judge came out with, and I've got a quote here because I quite liked the way that this was written, was the claimant's own view of the risks he faces, including the consequences of a successful attack on him, whilst genuinely held, were not so compelling that they had, as a matter of law, to be accepted by the expert and experienced decision maker, which the evidence plainly shows Sir Richard Mottram to be. So basically what he was saying is that, Harry was essentially saying that, like, I'm under constant threat. I'm going to die at any particular moment. I'm the most under threat person in the whole world. And so I should still get the same level of security because that threat hasn't diminished. The only thing that's changed is that I don't live in the UK all the time and I'm not a working royal. The judge basically was like, well, you can believe that you are under threat constantly and that the level of threat justifies a certain level of security. But these people who have access to information that you don't have and who are experts in a field that you are not an expert in have decided that the level of risk does not merit the level of security that you are asking for. And so, tough, basically.
get over it.
Yeah, you can feel you're constantly under risk, but in reality, that doesn't necessarily translate into getting the levels, you know, you're not the expert in this, basically. And so one thing the judge said was, you know, Harry thinks that they didn't consider risk at all, and that they only considered the fact that he was leaving the royal family, and that was the only reason that he wasn't getting the security. It wasn't actually about protecting him and his family. But the judge said, well, clearly they actually did consider the risk a lot more than you think that they did, because if they hadn't considered the risk, you would have got nothing. So the judge essentially said they did consider the risk against you. It's just that it wasn't the only factor that they considered. And there's nothing unlawful about that because of what we've already covered earlier about the fact that, you know, there has to be some other criteria that qualifies you to be part of RAVEC. And so your status as a working royal is obviously part of the conversation. But I think what I found interesting about this whole conversation is I think that, you know, they provided a lot of examples of emails, and obviously we have like the general argument that Harry was making. And I think that Harry comes across as really, really paranoid.
There's a lot of the times in his emails, in his letters, in his statements to the court where he talks about what happened to Diana. And the assumption, and even, you know, he talks about things like whenever the paparazzi are near his car, it's like he describes it in a way as if he's being physically attacked. It's very emotive. Mm-hmm. And it's very much like history will repeat itself. He used that phrase like quite a few times in this one judicial thing. It's very, he is very convinced that there is a high likelihood at some point that he is going to be killed, or at least someone is going to try and kill him. and that came across really, really clearly.
Mm-hmm. I do think it's interesting that he mentions on several occasions the paparazzi and the way that they are a threat. And he talks about like specific examples. They use the New York situation. They use the situation where they were chased by paparazzi leaving the Well Child event when he was in the UK as examples of like, well, obviously I need a higher level of security because of this sort of intense paparazzi presence at all of the events that I attend. And then the judge pointed out, and the defendants pointed out, that Ravek provides armed high level security personnel, and they are not there to monitor the paparazzi or to stop invasions of privacy, which I think I remember when there were pictures of Harry naked in Vegas were published, and there was a lot of people like, well, why didn't the security take the person's phone? It's like, well, that's not their job. Their job isn't to worry about your PR. The judge said, like, he recognizes that when the paparazzi are there, it is possible that they can cause harm, but Ravek are there for people who have like a specific intent to harm. So it's not about, you know, chaos that is caused in the moment by people making poor decisions. Any bodyguard can handle, if they're good, should be able to handle a paparazzi, you know, a photographer who's getting in your face and annoying you. You do not, essentially the argument was, you don't need access to top level security information in order to deal with a photographer. Point of Ravek is to stop things like, yeah, terrorists and bombs and, you know, very specific high level attacks that you need top secret level information to get to tackle.
Yeah, I think the judge was really fair. There was a part where Harry was talking about how, like, you know, the last time this happened, it was for his mother, and it was all like he's really worried it's going to happen again. And there was a part where the judge said, even though it's technically not relevant to the case, we have to consider it because mm-hmm. it's had such an impact on Harry. And, you know, it really clarified almost for me a lot of the difference between Ravek and like police. Because in my head, I was like, security, security. Like, if I ran, I've always felt like walkabouts, like, mm-hmm. I could not get my head around how they worked. I know how they work in practice, but I'm like, well, if someone in the crowd has got a weapon, the royals are right there. They're like next to each other.
Yeah.
But it really clarified for me that like Ravek, these high level security, they deal with the big threat. Like the ones that are hinted at on the deep web. The ones that we, the general public, are almost never going to hear about.
Yeah.
I think are the ones that Ravek dealt with. And it was so clear from what the judge said and from what Harry said that Harry could not differentiate between a genuine threat to his life and something that scared him or made him uncomfortable. It's a really clear distinction that I found really hard to figure mm-hmm. out before.
Yeah. There was a bit where we got an excerpt from an email from Harry or from his team that was sent. Every time Ravek offered him a package, every time he was visiting the UK, he didn't like it. And he said it wasn't enough. And there was one bit where he said that, quote unquote, his travel by train to Manchester worried him because of his proximity to the public.
I mean, me too, guy.
I mean, yeah, going on the train because of my proximity to the public worries me too. But like the presence of the public in and of itself is not risk. It's not murder on the Manchester Express. No one's going to kidnap you while you're on a metal tube going 100 miles an hour with no means of escape. Like that, it's you're just because there are people there who, I don't know, might take photographs of you or might come up to you and try and talk to you when you don't want them to, doesn't mean that you have to have high level trained personnel. Your bodyguards can deal with that.
Yeah, the judge in the verdict mentioned something about the sort of real distinction between celebrity mm-hmm. Who need security and people of status. The threat has to be so big for Ravek to be involved. Like, it has to be significant, not just for almost like the person in the centre of it. Like, with Amalia, part of the reason, it would have been awful for her if anything had happened to her, but it would have been awful for the Netherlands if anything had happened to her. And the relationship between Netherlands and the group that had taken over the country they were from. And I think there's a lot of people in the world who are mean and are unkind and have been unkind to Harry and Meghan and their children online. And I personally wouldn't want to talk to them either. But even if one of them attacked Harry and hurt him or killed him, it wouldn't cause a national outcry in the same way it would if he was killed by a terrorist group.
It would point to a larger issue of national security, wouldn't it? If they can't stop a terrorist attack against Harry, everyone would feel unsafe. The third and final point that Harry was advancing, I mean, there are quite a few points, but as I say, they were, most of them fell under those first two anyway. The only one that is actually quite distinct, I think, is the fact that it was unfair, it was procedurally unfair. So essentially that it lacked transparency and that Harry wasn't able to defend himself. And the judge said, no, that's not true. And there are a few different reasons why, but one of the things he said was they were told, and based on the evidence that was provided, because you know, they provided a breakdown of every single part of this communication. Is you can find out everything that happened between whenever the 7th or 8th of January and the 28th of February. Every, you know, as early as a week after they announced that they were leaving the royal family in January 2020, they were told in a memo that they would probably need to get private security. And there are several examples throughout this process where somebody in the royal household, including including Harry's then private secretary, were told about the process, or where we have an email that says, oh, I just spoke to Prince Harry directly and explained the situation to him. There were like three or four different examples over the course of the sort of 6 or 7 weeks or however long it was that they decided, where Harry was told about the process and was told that he probably would not be able to keep the level of security that he'd had historically. And even Harry acknowledges that in 2019, someone told him about the RMB analysis process and about RAVEC. Essentially, the judge was saying, like, the idea that you weren't communicated with was wrong, because there are so many examples of you being told over and over again, this is probably what's going to happen, and we're currently making the decision, and this is how the decision is made. One thing that stuck out to me, I think, was, you know, Harry acknowledged that in 2019 someone told him about RAVEC, but he says that he didn't get an explanation of how RAVEC decides whether a person falls in the cohort or not. And my instant reaction when I read that was, why didn't you ask?
I mean, it's a fair question.
Yeah, there's so many examples of this where he was like, well, no one told me directly that this had happened. There's a lot of examples, basically, of Harry expecting everything to be handed to him on a plate. And there's no, like, curiosity from him. Like, if somebody said to me, this is the group of people who decide whether or not you get security, I would be asking, like, oh, who's on that group? And how do they make that decision? Just out of natural curiosity. So the fact that, you know, at that point, we think they probably were thinking about leaving already, and he didn't ever think to ask, like, it's just like, I don't know, there's just this attitude that comes out of it, of like, Harry sits in a room and gets told information and expects people to be able to read his mind and answer his questions for him.
It almost felt like a child.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very much relevant to this kind of idea of royals live in this weird cocoon where everything is given to them, and this is just proof of it, because he had the desire to go for a court case, but even then there was a part in the view where he was like, yeah, my friends have said that it's not fair, so it's not. It didn't even feel like it had come from him. It felt like it had come from people around him being like, Harry, this isn't quite right, you should be standing up for yourself, pal. Even some of these things, like there's the part with the threat assessments, and RAVEC were like, we never show these to anyone. Mm-hmm. They are just for us, like, we are only showing you this one because we are making a point in the case. Like, we're not showing you any of the other ones we made in the process of doing this, we're showing you one. And Harry and Harry's lawyers asked for the threat assessments about 20 times. He kept being like, why haven't we got the threat assessments? Why can't we see them? What are you hiding? And it was like, no one sees them. The king doesn't see them. The prime minister doesn't see them. Like, they're not, like, hidden from Harry. They just aren't given to anybody. And he just could not get his head around the fact that it wasn't given specifically for him because he wanted it.
Yes. It's not like a debate. It's not a debate club at school where you can kind of like, oh, well, if I can get my moment and I can say something really convincingly, I think I can talk people around. This is a decision that is made really with no regards to you as an individual, and is about sort of the threat, you know, the threat assessment and who you are and what the impact of an attack on you would be and all these sorts of things that are really nothing to do with you. And I think that's actually the deciding factor that the judge said was, you know, Sir Richard Mottram, when he was asked, said that even after reading all of Harry's arguments in the court case, if he had had all that information at the time, he would have made the exact same decision, and it would have been for the exact same reason. Even if it was unfair that Harry wasn't allowed to, you know, go to the big, you know, kick in the door and go to the big RAVEC meeting and say, hey guys, actually this is why I should get security, even if he'd done that, it wouldn't have made a difference. I think it kind of reminds me of like defamation law, of like, if you say something about somebody on the internet that is untrue, that if somebody takes you to court and says, well, this isn't true, that's not enough. You have to be able to demonstrate that the fact that they said this thing about you that wasn't true damaged you in some way. That's what makes it defamatory. It's a similar thing of like, even if it was unfair, there was no actual harm that the unfairness caused to Harry, because the decision would have been the same even if he had been able to represent himself. So therefore it wasn't unlawful.
Yeah, and it kind of reminded me of the part where Harry was talking about he kept referring to this a mysterious person
Yes,
who had a
yes.
better sort of circumstance than him. It was the
Yes.
name of this person's been redacted, so we don't know who it is. And Harry kept saying like, or Harry's lawyers kept saying that the package she was being offered was different than this redacted person, and his friends were telling him that it wasn't fair that he was getting this because this redacted person was getting something better. And I mean, first and foremost, surely they don't know exactly what everyone else has got. I'm sure they don't sit around the dinner table and go, "So, guess what
Yeah.
I've got in my security package?" And even if they do, if Harry's friends know that someone is spilling national security secrets, and I feel like that needs to be looked into.
Yes, probably. Yeah.
But secondly, if you think of everything we've spoken about so far, it doesn't matter if someone else is getting a different package than him. I can't keep calling it a package, it just sounds like a spa resort. But it doesn't matter if someone is being treated differently because people are different. So this other redacted person, Harry doesn't know, and neither does the person involved, probably, the threats that Ravik has found against them. So Harry can't say that he's being treated unfairly because someone else is treated differently without knowing all the facts, which no one has.
Yes, I mean, I'm going to go out on a limb and say it was Andrew. It was the only part of the redacted text that I was like, I think I know what this says. But either way, I think that the judge made the point of like, we don't compare your security provision to somebody else's and say, oh, well, that person has more, so Harry should probably have more. Like, they don't, that's not how they make the decision. The decision is made based on you and your situation and your context. And that was what was offered to Harry. He was given something special because he is in a special situation. Whereas this other person, clearly, you know, they did, it's redacted, so we don't know exactly why they made the decision that they did about this other person, but clearly they aren't in a different situation. So the, you know, it was very like, well, but he gets it, so why don't I get it? And the judge was kind of like, well, that's not how it works. We don't sort of benchmark you against each other.
Yeah, it felt like a little brother being like,
Yeah.
I imagine like it was always like when they were growing up and he was like, "It's not fair. How come William gets to stay up till 7 and I have to go to bed at 6?" And it's like, because William's older than you and that's how things work. You know, it felt like that when I was reading it. Like he was like, "But it's not fair because these other people get something different from me." And it's like, yeah, but you're getting something better than them.
Yeah, so we've kind of, I know some of it was quite dense and quite confusing. If you have to go back and listen again, that sounds probably sounds really patronizing, but I had to read the document twice to understand some of it. So if you have to go back and listen to some parts of this podcast again, won't blame you. But those are basically the reasons why the judge found against Harry in all of his arguments. There, yeah, I think there's some general observations that didn't really fit into any categories for me. I think one of the things that was interesting was that the, I don't know, it sort of challenged some of the prevailing narrative that the royals weren't supportive about of Harry and Meghan and immediately cut them off and were really terrible. So what surprised me is that a lot of this stuff is actually still, they still use the palace as like a go-between. So a lot of the like requests will go to somebody in the palace and that goes to the Home Office. So the royals are still very intimately involved in a lot of this, sort of the process of how Harry gets his security. But also like, this, we haven't seen the full text of the Sandringham Agreement, but we got some sort of hints of what might be in it. And that was on 30th of January 2020. And in that document, it says that the royal family agreed to argue in Harry and Meghan's defence. So they said, like, ultimately, who gets security and who doesn't and what level they get is not our decision, but we will advocate for you. They supported them finding private security in Canada. So I just thought it was interesting that, like, you got the narrative was like, Harry and Meghan were being punished by the royal family who did, and you know, there's obviously some parts of the conversation that may we maybe aren't have don't have access to, but it does seem to me like actually the royals were much more supportive and much more on team Harry and Meghan than has been implied.
Yeah, because there was a big part before the sort of way back when Harry launched the legal case that he'd offered to pay and it wasn't being allowed to. And within the document, that happens. But prior to that, the royal family offered to pay from their private funds. And it's it I kind of, even if I'd assumed that they had helped, which I didn't, to be fair, I kind of assumed that they'd just gone like, off you go then. But I assumed it would have stopped after that 12-month cooling off period. But it hasn't. It's carried on since. And every time Harry or Meghan come back to the UK, everything is sorted out through the palace. The palace is and kind of pushing for it above what I would assume that they would probably do for anyone else in the family. They go, yeah, we have to make sure Harry's coming back on this day. Let's get him some, let's get the thing sorted. Let's get him a security guard. Can we make sure that you're talking to his security guards, please? Because they're going to be there. And it was very explicit. A lot of it was literally in quotation marks, so quoted facts that had happened.
I think that Harry expects the royal household to go, this is unacceptable. We are not going to accept this level. Whereas they've kind of gone, we made our case that we wanted Harry to have more security, but ultimately it's not for us to decide. So we're not going to stand up for every single situation.
I have another random observation, which is that the initial time when Harry and Meghan left the UK in January 2020 and what has ended up and what they said they were going to do and what's ended up happening since are completely different, which is probably not a surprise to anyone, but there was so much in this kind of initial 2-month period where they were talking and Ravik were talking about being told that they were going to be living in Canada at least for another year, that they would be regularly returning to the UK to do engagements, and they were asking for more information from Harry and Meghan via their private secretary, who then was giving them kind of, it was described as like being like really vague, generic details rather than specific facts about what was happening. So they'd be like, Harry and Meghan, what are your plans over the next 6 months? Because we'll see how we can make this work when we're making our plans. And then they'd be back being like, oh yeah, so we're just going to come back at some point to work, mm-hmm. maybe. Mm-hmm. And I know that obviously in March 2020, the world went into a global lockdown. But within 2 months of making these sort of statements, they were living in California, where they've lived ever since. They've not gone back to Canada to live there. They rarely come to the UK. And then even within that, they're kind of pushing against the guidance given by Ravik. So there's a part where Ravik say, one of the things that we need you to do is give us 28 days notice when you're coming back, like minimum, because that's how long it takes us to do a full threat assessment and give you what we're going to give you. And I think it was the first time Harry or second time Harry had come back, the first time for a visit, which was the World Child Awards in 2021, maybe 2020. And he gave them less than 28 days notice. It was like 14 or something. So they were like, well, we can give you something, but it is not the full thing. They're not the full package that we were offering. And I just could not get my head around the concept that even if you're, you know, in a strop because you don't think you're being offered something fairly, if someone says you can get the security you need, but I need this minimum amount of time to do it in, to then just not give them the time. Like, Ravik were technically well within their rights to be like, we can't do it in that period, so good luck. And they didn't. They gave them something. But it was this distrust between Harry and Ravik and the British government. And he's not helping himself by doing things that would keep him safe.
Yeah, because every other time since, there hasn't been any, he didn't cite any other examples other than New York and this visit for Wellchild, and then also the fact that he was very scared about being near the commoners on a train to Manchester. But he didn't actually say there was anything that happened on the train to Manchester. He just said that he wasn't, you know. So I think, yeah, it's even if you don't like the process, just don't do it. Just take your private security and that's fine. But this is what has been offered to you, and to not even try to engage with the process to see if it works before you decide. Like, at this point, this was the first time that he'd come over using this process, because did he come over for Philip's funeral, or was that after?
He did.
That was interestingly, they used the inward visitor processes, which is what they do for like high profile people who are visiting from other countries. And interestingly, also the person who's in charge of that process said, well, we don't do an R&B analysis when we have a visitor, so we're not going to do one for Harry. And Harry was again upset that there was, but that's the process they, in their case, that's the process they would use for everybody. They would never do an R&B analysis for an inward visitor. So, you know, that was just an interesting aside. But yeah, no, I think that, you know, this was the first time that it ever happened. And so, I'm trying to be sympathetic, because I can understand that he is very scared. And, you know, if I was in his position, I might feel exactly the same way, that I'm not being treated fairly. But once the decision has been made and it seems pretty firm that that decision is not going to change, you at least try it once before you decide that it's terrible, because you're not a security expert. You don't know how it's going to impact you to not have this, just have a slightly different arrangement of staffing or whatever. So I think to not, to sort of go into it with bad faith is an issue. Like, it seemed like he didn't even want to see if it could work.
And I mean, I have to be say, even though they were chased by the paparazzi, nothing actually happened. So even with that short period of security, he was fine. And I feel like Harry is so scared, and he is clearly scared of him or his family being hurt. And I'm not taking that away from him, but I think he is so scared that even though he had this journey where they didn't have all the information and still nothing went wrong, he's not taken that as a positive. Like, oh, look, this can happen even without the full security that I've always been used to, and I'm fine. He's taken it as I was chased by the paparazzi, therefore I'm at risk.
I think, if you go back and listen to episode 33, a lot of the things that the judges said actually are things that we've sort of said. It's just that we weren't coming at it from a legal perspective. We were coming at it from like our opinion as British taxpayers. Yes, you might be at risk, and I'm not saying that you aren't, and I'm sure that that is very frightening. And if I was in his position, maybe I would want as much as I possibly can get, and I would be fighting for that. Maybe, I'm not trying to undermine that, but you left your job. There has to be some sort of change in the level of job privileges or job benefits that you get. You don't continue to get the benefits of a job you no longer have. And it does seem like throughout this, they really went out of their way to offer something that was still recognizing Harry's risk, but that was sort of recognizing the unique circumstance that he was in and that he did leave. And so I feel like it sounds like what they offered was very reasonable. They could have said, "We are not a working royal, you're not getting anything, and that's the end of that."
They've said they're going to appeal, as all good lawyers do. I don't know where the appeal can possibly go from here, because I mean, I didn't spend all of my time reading legal verdicts, but I feel like the judge was very fair and took into account a lot of Harry's fears that legally he didn't have to take into account. I don't think we're going to be doing another episode in, a year's time when we're like, oh, and the appeal's overturned it. I think the appeal is just going to go, yeah, we stand by the court's decision. But it's soured, I think, a bit of the sort of the view I had of Harry, because I'm like, well, actually, you've just come across as someone who's spoilt, like a spoilt child. He still has Ravik security. He still has possibly more than many other royals. It's just different than what he had before. That is all we have got for you this week. Feel free to rate us 5 stars at all good podcast directories. And let us know if you have any ideas for our 100th episode, which is creeping ever closer. And until next time, it is goodbye from me.
And goodbye from me.